Hey, everybody. Welcome to our podcast. I'm Greg.
And I'm Ben.
Hey, welcome back, Ben. Yeah. And this is the Wheel of Time cast.
This week, we're covering the Wheel of Time, Season 2, Episode 5, Damane.
Damane. Oh, Ben, how you been?
Good. I miss doing this. I know other people have missed me as well. I don't believe it, but I read it, so it has to be true, right?
I mean, hey, like the internet is absolutely 100% of all facts all the time.
The internet doesn't lie.
That's what I meant. That's definitely the saying that I was thinking of.
No, I've been busy, so I apologize to anybody who expected me for taking so long to come back to this.
Yeah, I feel like we've had Veronica and it has been a really good addition to the show, and I'm really glad to have her. And but yeah, it's, you know, back to at least some of the old OG.
And of course, the first episode I come back, she can't be here, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, basically, you're the same person. It's just, you know, there's a voice modulator and.
This is just Veronica doing her best Ben impression. It's pretty spot on, I think.
Yeah, I mean, she's got skills.
So I'm excited to be back to it. I'm back to it for the rest of the season. I was so busy that it took me some time to finally get caught up with all the episodes. I've fallen behind with so many shows. Fallen behind in my own Wilhelm podcast. I haven't put out as many episodes as I've wanted to with that, you know, but thankfully we did wrap up our Lost coverage on Revisited, which is nice.
Yeah. I mean, then you guys are starting Ted Lasso soon, right?
Starting Ted Lasso this week.
Oh man, I totally got to get in on that. I mean, I could probably just comment on the first episode off the top of my head, but
September 25th is the first episode of Ted Lasso for Revisited. So yeah, we're getting encouraged with that. I don't know where that came from. Sorry, I'm shaking off rust. It's been a while.
No, it's no biggie, man.
I will say, though, I don't want this to sound discouraging, because I've been enjoying season 2 so far of Wheel of Time. Not as much as I like season 1, although that may have changed by the end of episode 4. I think it took a little bit of time to catch my attention.
I think like you, they were knocking a little bit of rust off and they were getting back into because that first episode, they really had to like reintroduce characters and, hey, where's everybody at again? And why do we care? And I think that they have started hitting their stride with the goings on the last couple of episodes.
Yeah, by the second half of episode 4, if not by the end of episode 4, with a pretty big reveal as to who a particular character was, I felt, okay, now I'm starting to get really invested in what is happening with these stories. One of the biggest faults I found of the first 3 episodes, though, and it continues, there's a fault that continues now, but although I can forgive it a little bit, is one of the things I don't like is when a TV series takes all of its main characters and separates them completely.
Right.
We have 5 main characters with 4 storylines happening. And to me, that's trying to juggle too much exposition, too much story. And it kind of takes away from the bigger picture. Even though in those first couple episodes, a couple of those episodes were literally within walking distance of each other and never knew it.
Right.
You know, so close and yet so far. But now that some of the storylines have become a little bit more engaging, I can forgive it a little bit.
So we're a bit beyond where you got to in the books, right?
Yeah, now we're going into a little bit of uncharted territory for me as well, which I'm totally fine with. I liked the fact in season 1, I had read the books leading up to where the season ended, with the reveal of Rand being the Dragon Reborn. You know, I had gotten past that point so far in the books, and I had known that already. But now we're getting to a point where I've read the introductions of these characters and then saw them visually happen. I'm okay with having a little bit of mystery now going into this story, because there's a couple things that have been revealed so far in these last two episodes that I had no idea and were genuinely a surprise.
So the problem with adapting a series like this, as you say, is that that's the way that the story goes. Like, the story is that they all split up and they have to find their way back to each other and so on and so forth. But what does end up happening, or what happens a lot in the books, is that towards the end of a book, or at least a couple of books, you'll have a conglomeration of characters pop in together and then something crazy will happen. And mm-hmm. So it's, if they maintain that same style and that same type of storyline, you may end up having a very similar type. What I'm really enjoying is the introduction of the new characters, and they are using the original characters to introduce the new characters. So like to you, it's a something that needs to be forgiven. To me, it's expanding the story, and kind of like Game of Thrones did. But I think that Game of Thrones, that first season, was so close to the books, but yet did it very, very well in engaging. Mm-hmm. Now, don't get me wrong, they had a lot of boobs, and you know, you can forgive a lot of things for boobs. So you know, that's just my viewing on it.
Well, and I could see that totally. And I, like I said, if a story is done right, you know, even if you have five separate characters telling five different stories, as long as those five stories are engaging, I'm totally fine with it. You know, hence the whole need to be forgiven part of it. But I think my issue with this is in those first couple episodes, and you kind of hit the nail on the head when you were talking about it earlier, is that they were shaking off the rust and they kind of had to reintroduce these characters to us. And that was kind of like, well, I already know these characters. I don't need all this new introduction right. of character. You know, and I get, you know, there was a little bit of time between season one and season two, so they kind of felt the need to do it. The only character I think maybe they should have done it with, or they needed to do it with, is Matt, only because it was a recasting of the role.
Right.
You kind of needed to use that time, that reintroduction of the character, to kind of ingrain it into the audience who's so used to seeing this other actor playing the role. No, this is now the actor you need to get used to seeing playing this role.
Yeah, I can see that. And that was one of the, in one of the stories that we'll talk about later. That was one of Ben Travers's issues, was that it's like a magical, oh, can this guy just shapeshift all of a sudden? I agree. All right. Anyway, so let's go ahead and hop on in. So we have our very informative Amazon summary. Moiraine and Rand flee for their lives. Egwene and Yanyev encounter a new foe. Man, I feel like I'm going to be saying this all season. Thanks a lot. I appreciate all of your insight.
And you know, the funny thing is, too, I'm looking at the IMDb page for the same episode, and it's exactly the same. So they literally ripped it from Amazon.
And I mean, I can appreciate the fact that they didn't, that they're not like going super crazy in detail. But I mean, like, this is literally like, what is that? Maybe 15 words. I mean, come on, give me something more. Anyway.
Yeah, you're spot on. It's actually 14. I was actually counting them as you were talking about it.
All right. Well, in light of Veronica not being here, we're gonna go ahead and skip Veronica's three questions portion. And now that we have been back, we're gonna go ahead and take a little break. And I know it's been a lot of excitement, and everybody's been super stoked to hear Ben's voice. So we'll take a little break. We'll kind of collect our bearings a little bit, and then we'll be back in a couple of minutes after these wonderful, wonderful commercials. Oh, huzzah! Those were some wonderful things that you could either buy or subscribe to or whatever.
I might have already subscribed while we were on break. I don't know.
Oh, that's actually a really good point. I was messing around on my phone.
It's so simple. I mean, sometimes you subscribe to things and you don't even realize it. I might have already been subscribed or have purchased that said product or products.
All right. Moving into our highlights. So, Ben, I think you said that you were going to do kind of highlights from what you've seen already, as opposed to just this episode. But you may tie into this episode anyway. But go ahead and, as you coming back, hit us with your first one.
Yeah, I'm going to apologize to anybody who's listening, because my points are going to be a little bit broader, only because this is my first episode back, and there are some things I want to kind of touch on, but I'm going to try and relate them as best as I can to this episode. And one of the things I want to talk about first, and I'm sure you and Veronica have already spoken about this. And again, I apologize, because I have, in my event to catch up, I've yet to go back and listen to the previous episodes of the podcast. I will have by next week, and by next episode when Veronica hopefully returns as well. But so if you've already talked about this, I apologize. But one of the things I loved about this show in season one, and has kept true in season two, is just the visual aspect of this series. I've kind of blown through the first four episodes and then spent a little bit more time concentrating on the fifth episode. But even this fifth episode, visually, as far as the environment, not just the environments that we get, but the costumes in as well. I mean, you would probably know better than I do, but the race that we, or the group that we got to know a little bit more in this episode, the ones with the long fingernails.
The Shanshan, yeah.
The Shanshan. The head guy, the head muckety muck of that tribe.
High Lord Turek.
Thank you. I knew, you know, there's a reason why you host this podcast and not me. Like, even just his outfit alone, with the white tapers going across and kind of making, it's kind of like a very see-through outfit. Like, you can definitely see the what he's wearing underneath of it, but at the same time makes him a very broad and feels like a very big character. And costume design like that, I find so brilliant. It's so minimalistic, but can just make a character stand out. And one of the things this show has done exquisitely, both in season one and season two, and they just keep seeming to raise the bar on that, is the costume design and the visual nature of everything this show gives us. Even in scenes where it's dark, like, the visuals are just so on point that I feel like, and this is giving Wheel of Time high praise, I feel like Lord of the Rings has a lot to live up to as far as visuals go when Lord of the Rings debuts, whenever it debuts. I have no doubt they will live up to that high praise, but I will be genuinely shocked, because what this show has given us visually so far has just been outstanding. It's enough for me to forgive any elements of storytelling I have problems with. Seriously, I'd watch it just for visual.
I mean, to be fair, like, Numenor was pretty impressive in the Rings of Power, but I think that there have been, at least specifically in season one, there were several vistas in Wheel of Time that were just phenomenal. You know, I agree with you. The visuals in the visuals in here, and the one that I in this one in this episode in particular, the one that I wanted a closer look at, was Kyrene, or if you read the books, Karhain. So I did not know that you pronounced it Kyrene, but it was towards the end of this episode, and it was when they were going. It flashed to Rand and Moiraine walking through the city, but you see it like in the distance. And the reason that it, one of the reasons it struck me was last week that Veronica had asked me what the significance of the town of Kyrene was. And I was like, oh, that's like a capital city of a country. And there's like, oh, here's a palace. And like, here's the city gates and the city walls. And that one in particular, I was like, oh man, I wish that they had like zoomed in a little bit to be able to see a little bit more of the detail around the city itself.
Mm-hmm.
it looked like one of those old time paintings of a vista with like a city in the middle of like a forest. It was really cool.
It's funny that you said the old time paintings too, because that's actually something that was in my mind, is it looked almost like a watercolor.
Right.
You know, and I say this with all respect. I don't mean this in a derogatory way. Like something like if you were in a family owned Italian restaurant, like this would be a painting that was on the wall of an actual village.
Exactly.
You know, that existed somewhere in wherever, like in Italy or Naples or Sicily or wherever this family is from. Like, yeah, it felt like something that was very, like, it felt like a watercolor you could actually explore.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree that the visuals have been phenomenal. You good for that?
Yeah. Like I said, I just kind of wanted to touch base on that because no matter what issues I've had so far and whatever I've loved so far, like the visuals have just been constant through the first 5 episodes of something I have absolutely loved.
Awesome. All right. So I'm going to stick closer to this episode, but I want to talk about the dynamic between Ishmael and Suroth, and the Shanshan in general. So it seems to me like High Lord Turak, he believes that he is fighting for the light. He thinks that he is a hero in his own story, or at least in the Shanshan story. And he is maintaining the honor of the court and the nobility and the blood. Hey, you, Suroth, you endangered our capability. You endangered our, you know, light-blessed opportunity to come and reclaim this land. And so, and then you sassed me for it. So you're going to pay for that. You know, Turak tells her to kneel. And then she looks at Ishmael. So we find out later that yes, she is in fact a dark friend and she knows who Ishmael is. She still has a bit of that ego from being one of the blood and one of the, you know, apparently the royalty of Shanshan and the nobility. It's funny because she says that she says to Leandrin later on, we respect the one power so much that we don't allow it to be controlled by accident of birth. However, that's how nobility in general is. Like it's literally by birth, but you happen to be born into this family, you happen to be born into the blood, so you treat bloodlines as important, but the accident of the one power by the same, you know, fortune or misfortune, you mistrust. But yeah, so I really did enjoy Ishmael. I'm coming to like the actor and the and his portrayal of this character a lot more. One of the things that I'll just make this point. Ishmael, he has, you know, apparently just, you know, appeared on the scene some months ago, I guess after Rand freed him from the Eye of the World, and then it was like, oh, hey, where can I go and get some control? Went over to Shanshan, and you know, from this side, from the Eye of the World, not sure where that is exactly, but I feel like it was up in the Blight somewhere up north. And then just kind of infiltrates the Shanshan court, and then points out omens of, hey, it's time to go back because it's, you know, it's time for me to go back. So let's hurry this thing along.
Yeah.
And then his interactions with Lanfear, I guess I'll talk more about that a little bit later on, but their you know, old tongue toasting and discussions I found very, very interesting. And so, yeah, the Ishmael was he was a pretty significant portion of this that I really enjoyed.
I'm with you on the like, it's weird to say the likability of that character because we know who he is and what he's capable of and how evil like the shadow is for him, and that's what he's a part of. That's who he is a lieutenant of. So to say like this character has a likability is kind of odd, but I kind of agree with you. To give a character, especially more so in this season than in season one, this kind of, I hate to say even like charming.
Charm is exactly the word I was thinking of.
Yeah, like this charming personality to kind of make him a more, maybe not likable, but like attractive character. Yep. In a sense that like you just can't help but be engaged in what he says. And it kind of plays into his character really well, because as you were talking about, like, High Lady Sarath, I kind of had that sense before it's revealed that she knew who he was, that maybe he was more the puppet master and she was the puppet.
Right.
And then you realize that's exactly what is happening. And now it seems like that's almost extending a little bit more with High Lord Tarak, and that that's the role he's going to play with him as well, you know, in giving of the gift. And, you know, it seems like, okay, he's now, because Sarath is kind of out of power. She's kind of out of praise with Lord Tarak. Like, now he kind of has to make his play in with Lord Tarak. And he's going to play this exact thing. It's going to be, he's kind of going to influence High Lord Tarak into what needs to be done. High Lord Tarak is going to believe that these are his decisions and his mindset of what needs to be done, even though he's completely being influenced by Ishmael. And like, it's such a really cool dynamic to kind of watch with all these characters, that even though, yes, they are evil, they are the villains, you can't help but be engaged in everything that is happening.
Engaging and charismatic. Those are the words that, I mean, I think charming was a little bit too nice, but charismatic, I mean, Negan was charismatic too, and people love him, and he was a horrible person.
Yeah, I covered all of season one of Dead City because nobody else wanted to do it. Well, no other hosts wanted to do it. Jason in particular. Sorry, Jason. But I did it because of what you just said. I found Negan to be an incredibly charismatic is the right word. Maybe not charming, but charismatic. And now I'm kind of getting the same sense. Not only in, it's weird because you have Ishmael, who is this charismatic character who we mentioned, but we have this Lanfear now, formerly Selene, which that was a big surprise to me. You know, Lanfear being this other lieutenant that was now called up, that she's engaging, but for a completely different reason. Like, she's more of a sensual attraction now to this character, like, because she is that way. She's very sensual and very sexual of a character, but she's also incredibly powerful.
Right.
And that to me is attractive as well. So as a viewer, like, we have these two lieutenants who I'm totally engaged with, but for two completely different reasons. And seeing them even engage with each other just makes it even more engaging now for me as an audience member.
I really think that they are doing a very good job of transmitting these characters in particular, because some of this stuff you don't get in the books. And this very much is something that amplifies the experience of someone who is familiar with the source material. It's not just, you know, a play-by-play. Don't get me wrong, some things are very, very similar, but they're adding in extra things that, and, you know, kind of like they did with Game of Thrones, they're adding in scenes that you didn't see. And because you didn't see them, you get more clarity and more like, oh, that, okay, that makes more sense as to why, which they have to do because it's a television show, and you can't, you know, you can't be like, oh, hey, I got this one viewpoint and that's all that I got, and so I have no idea. I'm really, really liking the Forsaken scenes, and which, I mean, oddly enough, those are ones I used to look forward to as well, in the books. So maybe it's not shocking that I'm engaged by these.
But I mean, and that's something I kind of go to the defense of when it comes to adaptations. And adaptations is exactly the word. It's like this is an adaptation of a story. It's not an exact word for word, scene for scene of anything. You mentioned Game of Thrones doing it. Now, you know, Wheel of Time is doing it. Lord of the Rings did it as well. Although Lord of the Rings was pretty close to the story. Hence why those movies are, if you watch the extended versions, 11 hours of movie. And even that, to me, as a reader of the books, is not enough. You know, but like, you know, you talk about, and one movie I come to defense of that was a movie off of a book is Ready Player One. There were a lot of people that had issues with the movie compared to the book because there were so many differences. And my defense of that is, and I apologize if we're kind of going off the topic of Wheel of Time, but one of my defense of that is, one, do you know how much of a nightmare it would have been for them to get the rights everything that is in that book? And two, do you realize how boring parts of that movie would have been if you adapted it straight from the book?
Right.
There's so much exposition in that book about telling of lessons and school lessons and like history. Like, I would be bored out of my mind watching that as a movie. So you can't do a straight adaptation, but you're right. When it comes to things like this, like Wheel of Time, where they're adding in new elements, and yes, it is exposition, but it's added exposition that adds such a depth to characters and locations and backgrounds that it's just, it's welcome.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I am totally digging it.
Yeah. I guess that brings me to one of my next points. You know, I talked a little bit about how we had these five different characters with five different stories going on, and I was kind of waning on some of them. However, one of the characters and the background that they had going on has kept me engaged pretty much from start to finish, and I really am curious to where it's going. And that's the storyline with Perrin. You know, everything that was happening and his abilities and like the honing of his abilities and them coming front. And now in particular, in this episode, with the addition of a new character with Evendahl,
what?
How is it pronounced?
Avienda.
Avienda. Wow, I was way off.
I was like, what?
Samsonite. I was way off. Say it one more time.
Avienda.
Avienda. Thank you. Now that I've heard it, I know it. That battle with Perrin and Avienda against the Children of the Light.
It was glorious. It was so good. Was
so, like, I couldn't stop watching. Like, she is a total mystery of a character to me. And I even said this in, I think it's season one, this was one of my points as well, that Perrin was a character I was really kind of like attracted to as far as like the character, not physically, the character itself.
No shame in it, man.
I wanted to know more about this character. He was the one that kind of drew me in the most out of everybody. And that continues with this season, with, like I said, with his abilities, with him being able to see the things that he sees. And then all of a sudden we meet her and I'm like, Perrin who? Like, this, who is this character? I want to know more about this character. And I did do some background into her. I won't reveal any of it because I don't know what's going to be explored and such. And if there is, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but man, the Perrin storyline kind of just went up like two or three notches.
Oh, absolutely.
When we get this scene with the Children of the Light or the White Cloaks, whatever you want to call them. And we meet Avienda and just the dynamic between these two characters and like, I mean, there's just that scene right before the battle starts where she pulls that mask up and she kind of glares at Perrin. And it's kind of like the whole, don't worry, I've got this look.
Yeah, do you like to dance, Perrin Ibarra?
Yes. And it's just, it's so badass. And I now want to know so much more about this character.
I mean, I think it was obviously very reminiscent of the scene of the pregnant Aiel. In season one, the opening, eight, where she was just like, just messing knights up and just going bonkers, just straight up murdering these people. And I mean, I would say that Avienda killed at least four of the children, just from like snapping their necks with their legs and, you know, flipping them over. And then parents straight up using a giant hammer and just pounding the crap out of their helmets. I was just like, whoa, That was pretty brutal. Even after watching Uno be completely impaled like last week.
Man, that was rough.
Yeah, that was. I mean, I was like very, very much. I was like, that was okay. He got Game of Thrones.
yeah, pretty much.
but you see a lot of this violence, and honestly, I kind of welcome it because it's kind of passed by in the books. It's more of a it's more of a family friendly version. You read about it, you kind of hear about it, but you don't viscerally see it. Mm-hmm. I think it was one of the things that really drew people into Game of Thrones, and it is something that makes me go, okay, you know what, hey, you're raising the stakes that people are being murdered, and yes, like straight up murdered, and it's by one person. Going back to last season, Tom Marilyn talking about the Aiel that just happened to be set upon by the people who killed him and then hung him up in the cage in Breen Spring. Child Bornhold this episode said it took five of your men to take her down and another seven to get her in the cage. I mean, so the Aiel are fierce fighters, and very impressive in their combat skills. This season, I have been a little bit slow on the Perrin. I've been a little like, come on, let's just show me what you got. And here he showed me, and like he showed a little bit. I don't think it was last episode. Might have been the episode before last, but where he started defending Loial in the battle in Atuin's Mill, and actually started like bashing some people. And here he's just like, okay, well, she's gonna handle like eight of these guys. I'm gonna bash the crap out of two or three of them. So I agree with you. This episode in particular, Perrin's kind of gotten away from the brooding, woe is me, and he's kind of coming into his own, and all it took was the life-threatening danger of his friends.
Yeah, I mean, in his defense too, the whole woe is me attitude that he had in season one, he had legitimate reason.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying that to watch it for nine episodes, it was kind of like, come on, just give me something. And then like the first two or three episodes of this one, oh, what are we doing? Why aren't we doing? No, you know what? Hey man, just like Elias is coming to help you, and get the hell out and go mess with the wolves and figure your crap out, and let's go F some people up, man.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, that kind of plays into like the issues that I had with the first couple episodes, and that like five separate storylines, not all of them are engaging. I mean, and it's right. Just kind of like, I get it. We're reintroducing these characters, and Perrin was one of them, but I was still engaged because it might've just been carryover from my interest in the character from season one that kept me engaged, where, his storyline would come up and I'd be like, ooh, it's Perrin time.
Right.
And I get to watch it. But now it's gotten to a point where I'm like, yeah, give me more of this story. I want to know what's happening.
You mentioned the chemistry of Avienda and Perrin. And I really saw it sitting around the fire, at the end, right? Where do we go? And then the laughing at, her laughing, I'm not going to attack you in a fit of lust. Yeah. That was nice to see Perrin actually like kind of connecting with a person that is not a matter of, mortal danger. Like it's a matter of, hey, I kind of like what you're doing, and you're trying to explain to me the ways of your life, and I need to go help my friends, so if you're going where I'm going, we're going to Falm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and another thing too that I liked about this too, and maybe this is looking a little bit too deep into it, or maybe it's not, I don't know, but I mean, he's very in tune with the wolves, which are canines, and canines, to anybody who's a dog owner knows that dogs have a good sense of character. They have a good sense. They know whether somebody has true intentions. They know whether somebody has evil intentions. Dogs are really good about being able to judge that. It's why, you know, if a dog likes you, it's usually a really good sign for that person. And Perrin seems to have that instinct as well. I mean, he knew Alvienda was in a cage. This white cloak is telling him how bad of a person she is. The last person to reach in ended up with a broken arm. He's just tossing the water to her. But yet Perrin knows that this is not to be true. He knows, just even without having conversation with her, like, he kind of has this sense that this is not the person they're making her out to be. And he opens the cage and he lets her out. And he's 100% right, at least as far as we know.
As far as his instincts go, I would agree with him. People don't belong in cages. And I think what, rather than even judging from what a, you know, from a manner of, hey, I've got a good sense of this person's character, I would say it shows his character. Now, don't get me wrong, she wasn't like growling at him and reaching for him and anything like that. She was very docile. She was very, very, hey, that's going to be allowed, Wetlander. You don't want to draw people. Oh, well, you kind of saved my ass here. So, you were treating me with respect by, you know, offering me assistance. And then, you know, he couldn't walk away, from the town without leaving this person who helped him, in such dire straits. So I agree with you. He was absolutely correct in his assessment of her character, but like I said, I feel like it shows more to his character of, hey, I'm a decent human being, and decent human beings don't have other human beings in cages. That's just the way that it is, or at least it should be.
And I see it in that way too. I mean, I completely agree with you that it does say a lot about his character in the same sense.
But yes, Perrin's very good stuff. And now I'm glad that you talked about that, because I don't need to use one of my points for it. All right. Anything else on Perrin?
No.
Okay. I am going to go to a lesser known character. Varen. Varen Sedai, the brown sister who greeted Moiraine, who recognizes that one of the boys that she brought to the White Tower last fall was the dragon. We found that out, I think it was two episodes ago.
I think that's episode two, actually.
Episode two? Okay, so episode two. And Varen has arrived back at the White Tower after, you know, coming out of retirement. We are assuming, because of what she was telling Moraine about, you know, finding texts with regard to prophecies and Heron's branded on his hands, and I really enjoyed Varen's character, the sassiness, the kind of smartassness, I remember, I'm glad to see glad to see all that dust on that switch. I remember the one who was there when I was a novice, my ass was, you know, was purple from now to Sunday. But she's also, I'm going to kind of knock it a little bit, but also kind of praise it. So it's a little confusing for me, but like, she does have a lot of just long lingering looks. Like, she just like pauses and just stares. And then something will happen and she pauses and stares. And then she asks questions like, you would think that that'd be something worth remembering. And maybe it's because she's very pointed. That's just, she is just a person who speaks honestly and speaks with barbs if necessary. But when she was talking to Sheriam about, oh, you would think that the daughter heir of Andor and to the two of the most powerful novices ever leaving the tower would, you know, strike you as like something worth remembering. And Sharon's like, yes, you're right. that would make sense. Sheriam definitely acted like kind of befuddled. But then Varen has, you know, she uses her Aes Sedai sneakiness. She does, you know, she's like, oh, hey, you know, I was looking for this book. Oh, I still have this book. And the name of it was Meditations of a Kindling Flame. So I believe that that was a book about the first Emerlyn Seat. So the Emerlyn Seat is known as the Flame of Tar Valon. So the Kindling Flame, the first one, I think that was what they were getting at.
Kindling Flame sounds like, yeah, I mean, it sounds like something that would be, I mean, that's basically what, how you start a fire is you start a fire with kindling. So
right,
that would make sense if that's the title of that book.
Yeah. And
if that's what it's about.
And so her sisters, so she you know, met up with Naomi and Yessica. And so Yessica and her Eidetic memory comes in and, you know, reads some of these passages and comes back and reports back to Varen. And she's like, oh, but there's this odd tremor in the thing. And then, oh, compulsion. All right. So compulsion. Compulsion is exactly what you think it is. It is someone using the one power to make someone do your bidding. If anybody was confused by that, it wasn't like, oh, I'm compulsing someone to do that by, you know, blackmail or something like that. Nope, it is you are removing the will of someone to do what you want them to do. Mm-hmm. A weave of compulsion? Oh, but that must mean that someone in the tower is sworn to the dark. That means the Black Aja is real. Okay, so that means that the Black Aja was maybe a myth beforehand. People didn't necessarily believe it. Again, this is what it seems like to me. Or Jessica is Black Aja, and she is, you know, saying these things to lift suspicion from herself. I did like the Trixie Varen. I would say relatively simple tricks, but still. Using the bait and switch and the oh, what do I got over here? Well, now in my other hand, I got something on fire. I did like that.
Well, I mean, and even with Varen, when you mentioned earlier on, when you said like how she kind of has these long pauses in between where she kind of stares off and everything, do you think that is something intentional that she does, or is it just an acting technique? I mean, because Shatner did the same thing, and you know, and it Varen seems a little bit better at it, but I mean, to me it seems almost more like it's a character trait for Varen rather than an acting, you know, because if you sit there and you say something or you ask a question and then you kind of put this long pause into it, you're kind of giving the person you're interrogating or asking the question to time to maybe second guess what their answer might be. So I feel like it could almost be like this is something she's actually doing intentionally.
Well, specifically, what I was thinking of was after Leandrin walked off, it was like, what are you doing? Hurry, we must go talk to the keeper about these novices being attacked by whomever. Mm-hmm. And then Varen like takes like three steps forward and then just like focuses in on her, and she's just like, huh.
Maybe that's just processing. I mean,
right.
You know, I mean, you don't see it, but there's a loading screen above her head because she's kind like, of taking, she's processing this information.
Right.
Because she needs to see whether or not like she actually believes it.
Yeah. And then I did think it was funny that Leandrin was like covering her tracks and like Varen was like, onto her, was like, oh yeah, no, I know. You can only get white asparagus in this particular place at this particular time of year. No, I get it. I mean,
it's totally, if to anybody who's ever seen the movie True Lies, it's totally whenever they bought Arnold a snow globe to bring home to his daughter from some place, from some city he was supposed to be in, when he wasn't doing a spy mission in a different country.
Right.
Like it's, yes. Like, why would you need to tell me, oh, this is the only place you can get this white asparagus, unless you are trying to get me to focus on that point?
Yeah. Like, oh, like, oh, where were you? Oh, I was obviously here.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it, just play into the whole, she already knows where white asparagus is from. Just give her the white asparagus. You don't need to tell her this is where you got it from. Right. If she knows where white asparagus is from, that's enough of the story. So it seems it was very clear that Leandrin was trying to cover something up.
Right.
At that point. I mean, we, as audience members, we knew it, but.
Right. Yeah. But yeah. So Varen was my second point.
Okay. Yeah. She's been a great character so far too. And I've enjoyed learning a little bit more about her as we go. There's been a number of different characters, new characters added, that I'm definitely intrigued with, but, I'm kind of going to go the opposite on that in my number one point. And my number one point is actually the happiness I've seen, even though they're not great characters, the happiness I've seen in seeing some old familiar faces from season one. In particular, the two that we get in this episode, Pat and Fane and Eamon Valda. Two not great characters. We both know that they're dark friends, but, well, is Eamon dark friend? Do we know?
No, I think he's just an evil.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, excuse me. Sorry. Try to make this as family friendly as possible, but yeah. No, I think he's just a horrible person.
Yeah, Pat and Fane we know is a dark friend. So, and that was revealed back in season one. But Eamon is kind of just I think he's just we're kind of learning that the Children of the Light are not as good as they seem to be, and Eamon is probably the worst of.
I would agree. He's the worst of what we have seen of the White Cloaks.
Yeah, exactly. Seeing these characters because of I'm a fan of how these characters were portrayed in season one. So seeing these characters return, bringing back these familiar faces kind of gives me like a nice little warm hug amongst this story that we're getting. But at the same time, it leaves me hope that there are some other characters we have not seen in a long time. One character in particular, who I am hoping is still alive and we're going to see again. And you kind of mentioned him already. Seeing Eamon and Patton gives me hope that maybe, just maybe, we'll meet Tom again down the road. And I know you already know. But are we going? Because look, I need another song from the Bard, man. It's like,
I get it.
He was, in the short time that we had Tom in season one, he very quickly became a favorite character of mine. And it's more like the charm, like we mentioned, yeah, with Ishmael.
For him, it really is charm.
And for him, it absolutely is charm. So it's, you know, seeing these familiar faces, it makes me appreciate the writing of the story, because it makes us, they're not forgotten characters.
Right.
And the fact that they don't forget characters makes me very hopeful that we're going to see Tom again.
Yeah. So when Padden Fane is strolling, he's like sauntering up with the Horn of Valir. Like, I feel like he should have been whistling. And I feel like maybe in the background they had like a little bit of like the music was kind of whistly. So like I was like, oh man, like he's basically just, he's like, I am here and what is up, bitches?
It's weird that you mentioned the whistling too, because I kind of felt the same way, because you're right. He just has this saunter, like he's got this walk, yep, about him. And it's a walk that very oddly just exudes confidence.
Yep.
And like he just has it, and he walks in and he kind of almost makes me feel like, we mentioned it before, it's kind of like Negan.
Yep.
And that's where the whistling comes in too. Cause like, I'm thinking like, cause Negan does the same exact thing. And I feel like you're right. He doesn't need it as a character, but even though cause I think we got him in episode one,
yep,
of this season. And then we don't get him again until this episode five. But even when we get him, it's just the character like is, again, we talk about charismatic characters in very short times that we get them, that when you see him kind of pop out and he's got the horn in the box and he just starts to do that saunter walk, you can't help but kind of smile.
Yeah. You can't, I mean, like, man, I can't, man, I hate this guy.
Yeah. I love to hate this guy. So yeah, it's just seeing these familiar faces just gives me hope that we're going to see some other ones as well.
Yeah. And Eamon Valda was, Valda was still, so shitty in this episode. I was a little surprised that he wasn't there to try to take down Avienda and Perrin, but
yeah. And it's the portrayal that he gives.
The
Abdul
actor's
Solis
phenomenal.
is, yeah, Abdul Solis is the actor, and he, man, it's such a fantastic portrayal of this character.
100%.
Yeah. So, but that's pretty much it for my number one, was just the familiarity of familiar faces and the warm feeling they give me when I get to see them, even if they're evil.
All right. So I am very tempted to go down the Sean Sean rabbit hole, but I will leave the Sean Sean for my notes. And I'm going to go through just some of the cool shit that we saw with Moiraine and Rand. This episode, like, I don't get me wrong, I could spend an entire point on Lanfear, and then this podcast would be like 2.5 hours long, and I don't have time for that. Ain't nobody got time for that.
Takes a long time to edit too.
Yeah, and so Moiraine, you know, we see her and Land, or her and Rand, excuse me, taking off. You know, lots of running, cardio, rule number one in the Wheel of Time. So they are running for their lives, and Moiraine, this is a cold bitch,
right?
And I get it. Like, I understand why you need to kill the horse. I get it, but oh, I can't leave her away to follow. All right, well, let's go. And then we're not going to, you know, we're not, I'm not taking the horse handler so that, so to save her, I'm taking her so that she can be the bait further down the road and lead Lanfear further away. Because it is most important that myself and Rand survive. Did you notice the Waygate, what I thought was the Waygate stone there? When she and Rand pop out of the bushes, it was kind of dark, but that you see like Lanfear ride past, and I feel like there was a stone that was like the Waygate from season one.
Oh, no, I didn't. I wasn't paying attention. I didn't see it.
Yeah.
I wasn't looking close enough to see it.
It was also dark, and I've noticed a couple of the dark scenes are kind of a pain in the ass to see if you're not in like a dark room and monitoring. And then what Lanfear did to that horse lady, about sewing her mouth shut with like maybe weaves of air or just power or whatever. That was bonkers. So Moiraine and Rand end up back in Kyrene, back at Lady Anvir's castle. We meet her son, who's going to marry the queen, Talmanis. And then Moiraine is just wiped, and Anvir kind of has her number. And I love the loss of confidence that she has. And I think that Rosamund Pike does a phenomenal job portraying that. And then Lady Anvir was her character, the same way we saw her with Rand, just telling him just random stuff about the game of houses and stuff. I thought that she was a really good character. And even though she'd been hurt by Moiraine, you know, over the last couple of decades, she, you know, she offers her the advice that her much older sister gave her when she was young. Which leads Moiraine to go, huh, maybe he doesn't need my protection and we can stay. I don't recall this at all. I don't think this was in the books at all, so I don't know what is happening. So I am interested to see this play is going to come out.
Yeah, that keeps things interesting for you too, as a book reader, to add these new elements, because now it adds a little bit of mystery to what's happening.
Absolutely.
To you too. Yeah.
Rand didn't really have much to do except just be upset like half the episode. and then Moiraine had a lot of the character development in Moiraine.
Well, because I mean, he was initially upset in the beginning that Moiraine killed his booty call. I mean, and it's, you know,
and I get it.
I totally get it. I mean, she flat out, you know, slit her throat, even though knowing full well it was gonna do nothing.
Right.
you know, so yeah, like this is actually something that kind of brought me back into the Rand storyline, is because, you know, the whole time, like the first three episodes, I'm like, okay, like Rand is helping these patients. He's living in this inn. He's got a friends with benefits situation going on with the innkeeper. I'm like, okay, like this dude is the dragon reborn. Like, what is going on? Like, he's kind of living this mundane kind of life. And I get it. He's trying to hide and people believe he's dead, but I'm kind of bored with this. And then we get that big reveal as to, you know, Celine is Lanfear. She is this high lieutenant with, you know, in the shadows. And it's kind of like, okay, now I'm interested.
Right.
It took Moraine coming in and slitting her throat. Well, not even then, like even before that, when she admits to Rand, like, I'm a creature as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then she starts doing some weird stuff. And it's like, okay, like, who is this person? And when Moraine comes in and like slits her throat, I'm like, all right.
Well, first she stabs her through the back with a sword.
That's right.
And then she slits her throat.
She slits her throat. So, I mean, but it goes to show too, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but Moraine doesn't have any abilities right now at this point, right?
Nope.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So, I mean, the fact that she was able to go into that inn or room, not in, they're in the cabin at this point because the inn had burned down, thanks to Rand. She was still able to sneak in and stab her and slit her throat. Moraine is very cold-hearted at this point, and I think she needs to be in order to survive and to help her and Rand survive. Not saying I forgive what she did, because the moment Lanfear met up with that horse lady, I was like, oh, this woman's doomed.
Yep.
Especially after what happened with the complete stranger that approached her earlier.
The decapitation is like the... Oof.
Yeah, so then when we see she meets up with the horse attendant, and I'm like, oh, this woman's doomed. You know, so I feel like Moraine kind of has to be this way because she has no ability. So she's kind of has to go down this darker route. The fact that she has no abilities but still snuck into that cabin, stabbed her, slit her throat, got Rand out of there, took a hit from Rand because Rand was acting impulsively, like, that still shows that even though she has no abilities, Moraine still got guts.
But by the barrel load, absolutely.
Yeah, she is a tough mother effer that I would not want to deal with.
Yeah, my note here is Moraine is ruthless.
Yeah,
absolutely ruthless.
She kind of does what she has to do, even in desperation,
mm-hmm.
to survive, and that takes a lot of intestinal fortitude. And it's not until she meets her sister and her sister gives her that advice that she kind of comes down from that a little bit. She kind of calms down and she's like, well, maybe she's right. Maybe I don't need to protect him.
Right.
Maybe, and then that's when, you know, she tells Rand, like, no, we're not leaving. They're done running. You know? And yeah, it's been a cool, interesting character dynamic to watch.
Yeah, I do really enjoy Moraine. All right. So there's a bunch of stuff that we haven't covered. So what notes do you have?
I really don't have a lot of other notes. We kind of talked a little bit about like Moraine using the woman as bait. I had that in my notes as well. You know, seeing Eamon again and hopeful that we get another song from Tom. I find it very interesting that, and this is really the only other note I have, and then I'll turn it over to you, is that we see different elements of power are represented by different things in different groups. And God forgive me, High Lady Sarath and High Lord Torak, they are
Shan Shan.
With Shan Shan, it seems to be the nails. Like, these are what kind of show the abilities, or not the abilities, but the power dynamic within them. Cutting off Sarath's nails kind of took away her power or her status. That's exactly what I was thinking at. But it also seemed like, from what I was watching it, you know, while her seemed natural and were cut off, looking at High Lord Turok's, they seem almost metallic.
Well, I think that they are armored. I think that they're
armored.
Are,
okay.
They're jeweled, and there's like protective, like Soroth had little things on the edges of her fingers that kind of like help provide support for the nails themselves. But I think that Turex is like specifically, those are bejeweled and armored. And it again goes more towards that status that you're talking about.
Man, if that's the case, I want armored fingernails like really badly. I don't know what I would ever do with them, but they seem not, and I don't want them nearly as long because that's just ridiculous. Maybe about an inch and armor them. That'd be kind of cool. But yeah, so seeing differences in these groups, like in all these different groups, and seeing, you know, even with the Aes Sedai, it seems to be the rings that they have are kind of their status with the, with Tor, you know, Lord Torak and Soroth, it's the fingernails. It's kind of, with the Shanshan, it's the fingernails. So I enjoy seeing like all these different intricacies and how status is represented in different ways among all these different groups.
Yeah, I would even compare it to from one country to another, you know, in our world, where it's a matter of, hey, in this particular society, it's technology that shows status. In this particular society, it's clothing that shows status. In this particular society, it's, you know, well, just as an example, you know, oh, the all of the higher up you are, the less hair you have in the Shanshan. Soroth had portions of her head shaved, but Turak was completely bald. I think that is part of it. I will say that that's part of it in the book. And maybe that's me reading too much into it. Maybe they're not including that stuff, but the obvious one was the fingernails.
Does that mean you are destined for greatness if you bald early?
Oh man, I am so good to go.
Me too. Yeah. That means I'm like predestined for greatness at an early age. I love it. But that's really all I have for my notes. We've kind of covered and touched base on everything else.
Okay. So this is going to be a long note section, and you might even just do have to do like an entire another point.
No, go for it. I'll just go get a cup of coffee.
All right. Sounds good.
No, I'm kidding.
All right. So Leandrin brings Nynaeve. We haven't even touched on Nynaeve, Elaine, and Egwene. She brings them through the ways.
Okay. I was going to ask that too. That is the ways that she takes them through.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And they came out the way gate and then met up with Soroth, and then, you know, Soroth talking shit at Leandrin, talking about, oh, our master's dog. He doesn't have time to come deal with his dog. And so then like they kept both referring to our master, and like outside of like the Empress, I was just like, are all of Soroth's like henchmen and the One Power people, are they all dark friends? Like they all understand that, hey, our master is you know, one of the Forsaken, and then some of the terms that they used. There's Suldam, trained for years to you know, prove that they are worthy of doing stuff. Didn't really get a ton of detail there. She did use the term Mereth Damane, which it sounded like she was referring to the Aes Sedai. That way all Mereth Damanes will be leashed. And then Leandrin like turns towards Nynaeve and like cuts Nynaeve free with the power. I didn't know if the people who could channel that are with them, or with Soroth, could like see with the weaves. Maybe it was I don't know.
Well, didn't we touch base on that last episode or last season as to whether or not people could actually see the weaves?
Well, I feel like women who could channel could see the weaves. But people who could not channel wouldn't. But if you had like the little ball gagged people in out with Soroth, and then like they started using the power, and I hope they get more into detail with regard to all of that, and like because they literally looked like they're being used as weapons, but they are trying to, Yeah, I really want to see the interactions between the different power users with the Shanshan. Mm-hmm. But then Nynaeve and Elaine escape. Egwene, you know, puts up like a just giant block of fireballs. And I was just like, whoa. And then she like turns around and runs away. And then so Egwene gets captured and has this leash put on her. And it's just like, oh shit. And like this like magical metal type shit. It looked like some Iron Man nanobots.
It did look like that, didn't it?
With the leash, and then it's almost like a telepathic link from whoever had the leash to the wrist of the from the wrist to the leash, or rather to the necklace. And I really want to know more about this. I want to know more details, and I want them to explain it to me better. But then Nynaeve and Elaine actually get back to Falm. So now Perrin's going to Falm. So Perrin's going to Falm. Nynaeve and Elaine are in Falm. Egwene's in Falm. And so Matt's going to Kyrene. Rand's in Kyrene. So we are having that merging of main characters again. But Nynaeve and Elaine are found by a woman of the an Aes Sedai of the Yellow Aja. You know, their names and likenesses have been put out and about. So I wanted to cover all of that stuff. And even if I didn't have like a full blown point to it. So things that we've heard: Suldam, Mareth Damane, Damane, Mareth Damane. In my head, I always said Damane.
And you told me how it's pronounced before we started recording.
Yeah, yes, I did. some people that we've been introduced to. So they said that Gawain was Elaine's brother, who he was. They're going to his name day ceremony. Browns are nerds. They are like hardcore nerds. We talked about Talmanis. Child Bornhold. He's apparently got a famous father who his father's name won't protect him anymore. I thought that was interesting, so I want to know who his dad is. And then Teleron Riode, and this is what Lanfear is the master of, and where we see her the instant that Rand falls asleep, he is immediately chained up and straight up 300'd with no shirts and crazy abs, and Lanfear is channeling Kate Blanchett as Hela on the throne.
That's a good comparison right there.
With the big veil and the crazy headdress, and I was like, but the actress who plays Lanfear very much reminds me, like physically, of Kate Blanchett. Very sharp lines in her face and like high cheekbones, and so that was a bunch of notes, and I think that's all I have. I did notice that I feel like a couple of the Aes Sedai use some words that is along the lines of, hey, I'm telling you the truth that you might want to hear, not necessarily the truth that is. Mm-hmm. So like Sheriam said, oh, it says here that they were escorted by a guard of Morghese's soldiers. So it appears that they left on their own. So she didn't lie. She did not say an untruth. She said, she used the words, it appears that all is well.
Well, I mean, it's kind of, it's kind of very similar to a character that we discussed in this last season of Lost on Revisited. And that's the Man in Black, in that he never lies, but in it's lying through omission.
Right.
You are just not giving all of the factual information.
Right.
You know, you're not lying, but you're not telling the truth either.
You're not telling all of the pertinent truth.
Yeah, exactly. You're not giving us all of the details. So, the only other thing I can say about this season in general, and this episode in particular, is especially after especially after meeting Ivienda, I hope we get badass Land back, because he seems very mellow at
very,
this point.
Very, very hippie Land right now.
Yeah, and I get it, because he's not connected to Moraine anymore. Like that connection has been severed. So I kind of get it. He's trying to find his purpose. I understand it, but man, I need him in a fight scene again. Sometime, hopefully before the end of the season. I'm sure we will.
Right.
You know, I miss that.
All right. Fair enough. I mean, I'm always about some shirtless Daniel Henney. all right. So we'll go ahead and take a bit of a break, and then we'll come back, and we got some feedback. So I'm super excited about that.
It took was me coming back.
Heck yes. All right.
That's not true at all.
See you in a few. All right. And we're back. And so we got some news, at least some stuff that I found some pretty interesting. There's an interview, due to the strike, we're not much interviews are we really finding, but a review by Ben Travers with IndieWire. The Wheel of Time is a hit fantasy series. Can it be more? I found this one pretty interesting because it's more of a negative, and I'm kind of, you know, touting all of its positives, and he has a little bit of a different view. If you'll spare a weary critic a moment of vulnerability, I must admit, I do not understand the Wheel of Time. I've now seen the first season of the fantasy adaptation twice. I've screened the available season 2 episodes while poking around in recaps and social media reactions. The books remain unopened, but I've gone over their synopses and summaries, so I feel like I've done my due diligence. I have given the Wheel of Time a spin, a fair shake, and a hard look. Nevertheless, I don't get whatever is going on here. In season 2, Mom and Dad are fighting, but I can't quite pinpoint how Lan failed Moiraine, or if it's just a limp excuse for added drama. The Dragon Reborn, who's almost certainly not the Dragon Reborn, right, is still in hiding, but he's happily banging an innkeeper, who's definitely not an innkeeper, to keep him from thinking about his one true love, Egwene, who he's decided to never see again, but desperately wants to remember. Speaking of Egwene, she's in training at the White Tower with Nynaeve, which is a perfect opportunity to explain how the magic and Wheel of Time actually works. And yet the Aes Sedai's abilities remain conveniently fluid and frustratingly opaque. They can conjure water out of walls and air, so is that why Moiraine takes so many baths? Because they're always available? The rules in the Wheel of Time are very loosely defined, whether emotional or practical, and both are beyond a casual viewer's comprehension. That could be a problem because Prime Video has a bona fide hit on its hands. When The Wheel of Time premiered in November of 21, its first 3 episodes netted a 1.16 billion minutes of viewing time in its first week. That was Amazon's best Nielsen performance to date and compares well with its next fantasy epic, The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, which pulled in 1.25 billion minutes in its debut. Both were surpassed by Reacher, but that's another story. Lord of the Rings went on to tally 7.52 billion minutes across its 7-week run, while The Wheel of Time tallied about 4.5 billion minutes in its own 7-week span. That's a significant difference, but an expected one. Lord of the Rings is a proven franchise in Hollywood, thanks to the beloved blockbuster film series, whereas The Wheel of Time is just getting started. So this is actually a much longer article, and for brevity, I cut down significantly, but like, where they go on to say that they don't have the numbers for season 2 yet, and I'm interested to see what those numbers are saying, but it seems like there aren't there aren't really scathing reviews out there, which is nice because I'm really enjoying the show.
Well, even when I check the ratings, like on Rotten Tomatoes, which shouldn't always be trusted, by the way. the ratings are high, and the season 2 ratings so far are even higher than season 1. Nice. through Rotten Tomatoes. So what really gets me in this article is both were surpassed by Reacher. I've never seen Reacher, but I didn't think it was more popular than Lord of the Rings. I mean, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Apparently, so I know Reacher, like it was Jack Reacher, and then this is the series based on like the books based on the books, which is based, the movie was based on, you know, the Tom Cruise was in a while back.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm an Alan Richardson fan, so I haven't checked out Reacher yet. It's on my list to watch eventually, but just the fact that Reacher surpassed both Lord of the Rings and Rings of Power, Wheel of Time. Like, okay, maybe I need to move it higher up on my list.
Maybe it's just that good.
Maybe, yeah. But in regards to kind of fun articles that you, that were found, in regards to this too, there's another one from Entertainment Weekly that just by the title alone, Liandrin goes full on Littlefinger, is just interesting enough. And this article is from entertainmentweekly.com, written by Alex Raymond. And he says, at the White Tower, Nynaeve, Egwene, and Elaine are, hold on, they're not at the White Tower anymore. They're deep down in the ways, the dark cavernous tunnels that magically connect desperate parts of the world. oh, that's not good. Turns out Liandrin's got them tied up and is planning on taking them to Ishmael. So yeah, if you had Liandrin is secretly a Black Aja on your bingo card, congratulations, you've won. I did not have that on my bingo card at all. Liandrin takes the girls through the portal and hands them over to Seroth. It soon becomes clear the two know each other and have been plotting this move for some time. There's no love lost between these two powerful women, though, as we get the feeling they're vying for the throne of this evil little cabal. But just as I was ready to cut Liandrin from my Wheel of Time fantasy team, she suddenly weaves a spell that unbinds Nynaeve, giving her a fighting chance to escape. Last week, I called Liandrin Wheel of Time's Littlefinger, and she's certainly earning that title this week, playing both sides of this conflict at once, a real 3D chess move on her part. You go, girl. So as Liandrin disappears through the portal and the Shaychan, is that it?
Shaychan.
I remembered. Move to capture Nynaeve, Egwene, and Elaine. The girls fight back, escaping into the jungle, except when Nynaeve and Elaine reach a clearing safely out of the Shaychan's grasp, they realize, wait, where's Egwene? Yep, turns out poor Egwene got left behind. And in a brutally effective scene, we watch the Shaychan put a magical collar around her neck, hook her up to a chain, and drag her off like a dog. Yeesh.
Yeah, again, this was part of a much longer review, but this one was relatively entertaining in the way that it was presented. I did really enjoy that.
And I did learn one particular thing from this too, and that's I should never use the terms go girl. Because they do not sound good coming from my mouth.
It's all about the presentation. All right. It reminds me of George Carlin. You go, girl, should probably stay gone.
Probably go. I know that bit very well.
Yeah, we did get some listener feedback this week, in part because I harassed some of my friends to leave feedback. And so that was great. I'm very much appreciated. So from Facebook, from Kristen Emmerich, I've always enjoyed Lanfear's character development. This is from episode 4. I've always enjoyed Lanfear's character development in the books. And I think the show is doing a really great job highlighting both sides of her personality.
I'm really into the Lanfear character.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's just, it's just a sensual character. It's this really engaging. The feedback also from episode 4 comes from Ivy Greer. Episode 4 was really good. I loved how we got a bit more background of Moraine and the strain of her absence on her family. I also loved the reveal of Liandrin as Black Aja. Man, everybody picked up on it and I didn't. I believe that she did feel invested in Nynaeve and was genuinely sorry to lose her, but I feel for her power more than the person. I feel this plays out more in episode 5 when she turns the ladies over to the Shaychan. I feel this was a play to break Nynaeve, to turn her to the Dark One, to truly make her a part of the Sisterhood of the Black Aja because she is so powerful. I think the others were just a bonus.
I completely agree with you, Ivy. I think that she did connect with Nynaeve in, like, I don't think it was an intent for her to find her with her son or anything like that. But I do think that she is mourning the fact that she lost that much power. And no longer has that the capability to tap into that.
Yeah, I can see that and agree with that as well.
Eric Emmerich, I enjoy hearing Veronica's perspective as a first time viewer with no book of learning, as it were. Seems the show is really getting across the plot points. As someone way too invested, I'm enjoying this turning of the wheel. And so some, I actually got some texts from Kristen earlier as I was, again, harassing her for feedback. She said, not a fan of all the bald cap usage. Egwene's capture was less emotional than I expected. I wonder if they're trying to make her look a bit colder as far as Nynaeve. I wonder if they're trying to make her look a bit colder and less emotional now because of everything she went through in the Arches. Rewatching this week, and Hopper just barked, and the subtitles called it chuffing. I've never heard that word used to be describe a dog's bark before.
I have. I think I have.
I may have, but it's not something that would just, oh, chuffing. Right.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Leandrin brought horses into the ways when Moiraine didn't, because she said they wouldn't survive. And then Moiraine murdered a horse this episode. That's weird.
Yeah.
And Leandrin only freed Danyev's wrists. And then subtitles say Ishmael says Matt was born mime, but that doesn't sound close to what he actually says. So Matt was born what? So Christian, I think I actually went back and like went and listened to this again and watched it. So I think what he was saying is Matt was born mine and Perrin will soon be more wolf than man. I think what he was saying was that it seems like what he's doing is he's trying to set up each of these characters to give them something kind of like Leandrin, where they have something that they need to hold on to or need to recover to, you know, Leandrin says every woman has her price. I think he's trying to tempt these people into getting something that they want or they need so badly they're willing to turn to the dark. I think with Matt, the point is that he was always like, he was born in my pocket because he's always going to give in to the easy way. He's always, there's no way I'm not going to get Matt because he's easy. He's cake.
Yeah. I took that exactly the same way. When he said Matt was born mine, that's exactly how I took it. Isn't that like, look, Matt's just so easy that I don't even have to think about it. Like this is already Matt's already a done deal.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I took it too.
All right. So, hey, thank you so much for the feedback. We really appreciate it. And please keep it coming. I swear I'm going to get more posts up. And so you guys can put it up, put them on Facebook or put them on the Podcastica website, call in, leave a message. Love to hear from you guys. After this, do you have anything else, Ben?
No, I'm happy to be back. I miss Wendy, but
yeah,
you know,
me too.
You know, I get, you know, sometimes, you know, life has to take a priority and whatever it is that has kept her away from returning to the podcast, you know, who knows, maybe by season three, we can coax her into returning and there'll be four of us.
Yeah. That'd be pretty sweet.
Yeah.
All right. For the moment though, that's our show. Thanks for listening, everybody. If you'd like to write in or record a message and send it in, you can email it to talk@podcastica.com.
You can check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/podcastica. And Podcastica is also on Twitter or X now, whatever you want to call it, at Podcastica.
All right. So I'm not sure. I know that you, like you said, you got Revisited is coming up with Ted Lasso and starting that, which I can't wait to rewatch for like the fourth time now. And then I know that Penny's doing a fun job over at Still Slaying, I think it's called, the Buffy rewatch podcast.
Yeah, I know they're not doing like a full-on rewatch. I know they're only picking maybe like some of the highlighted episodes of the seasons and going with that. Trust me, I know from somebody who just did a complete rewatch of Lost, it is a commitment to do a complete rewatch of a series.
Yeah, so, of a network series. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Because you're talking shows that went like 22, 24 episodes in a season.
Yeah, and there's 7 or 8 or 9 episodes of Buffy.
I think Buffy went like 8 seasons.
Yeah. Oof, yeah, that's a lot of episodes.
It's a lot. So they chose the right way in doing like the highlighted episodes.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I know that White Lotus is I think they just did season or episode one of season two, and I think coming up that's going on right now. And then Daryl Dixon, you know, just came on. I think they've got two episodes out now, which I got to catch up on.
Haven't started that one yet. I didn't have as much of an interest in that one as I did Dead City.
Yeah. Yeah. So charismatic versus somebody who just grunts all the time.
I mean, I mean, pretty much. I mean, if it was a story about him and his leather vest and his leather vest spoke to him, I would probably watch it.
It's like the Wilson next time on this podcast, Wheel of Time, season two, episode six, something that comes out on Friday.
Somebody wasn't prepared.
They aren't coming out. They're not giving us the titles.
Oh, they're not.
No.
Oh, then I take that back. I take back what I said because I'm a jerk.
all right. But that's our show. You want to do this one?
Yeah. Let the dragon ride again on the winds of time.
Yeah, that was a good one. Maybe you do it in the future. All right. That sounds good.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a United Healthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about United Healthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.